My name is Carrie.
Hey, Carrie.
And thanks so much, Billy, for asking me to come out and talk tonight. I owe AA a lot. I could never, ever repay what AA has given me. So it's an honor to come out here and talk for you all. It's also good, I like speaking because it reminds me about what it was like. It's really easy to have a great life now, and I'm overall, I'm really happy, and it's really easy to forget what I was like, what I used to be like, and so speaking gives me an opportunity to revisit that and look at, you know, what I was really like in a general way. Tonight I'm going to talk about, you know, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, I have a home group. It's the Old Town Speaker Meeting in Alexandria, Virginia. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor. And my sobriety date is October 31st of 2002. October 31st. It's a really good sobriety date. I like it. I want to keep it. Okay, well, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. Like a lot of people, my parents really didn't drink that much. I don't really remember them drinking much at all until I was, you know, maybe in my early teens, and the doctor told my mom to help her sleep, to drink a little wine before bed, so she'd get a little tiny juice glass of wine and sit there for like a half hour, like kind of drinking it. And there was a lot of like arguing, a lot of fights in my home. Everyone kind of had a bad temper, and I don't think my parents had the greatest marriage, so I just kind of spent a lot of time feeling really stressed out and feeling I think wanted it to stop, just, and then also with people outside, you know, with the public or with kids or whatever. My sister was really great and has always been really great at making friends. That's no problem whatsoever for her, but I was always terrified. Now I know it's self-centered fear. I was always completely occupied with how other people were thinking about me. And, you know, after I got sober and worked the steps and through my sponsor, you know, I learned that people aren't thinking about me like that. You know, it's the only one that's thinking about me nonstop is me. And that's kind of, through recognizing that, it's allowed me to, you know, through working the steps, and I think, you know, that's a part of those ninth step promises, is, you know, my fear of people can still crop up, but it's really, it's gone. It's not completely gone, but it's not to the degree that it was when I was a child. I was just so painfully self-conscious. And so we moved around a lot, and, you know, my first, I don't know, the first things, I always liked things that made me feel good. And kind of one of the first things that I abused was praise from my parents and from teachers and from authority figures. You know, I learned that if I did certain things, that they would brag about me and say how good I was or how smart I was or whatever. So I would do things purposely. I mean, it's very manipulative, and I can still find myself doing things today to try to get a response or get you to think this or get you to do this. And I've recognized that that's extremely manipulative, and thankfully it's not to the degree that it was when I was younger and drinking. But so I would do that. Then another thing that I kind of was kind of a drug for me or whatever, an addiction, was reading. As soon as I learned to read, that's all I wanted to do. I wouldn't play with my sister. I didn't want to look. We traveled a lot, and I didn't want to look outside the car at the, you know, we lived in Arizona for part of the time. We'd be driving by these, you know, miracles of nature and all this stuff. And my mom would be like, look outside. I didn't want to look outside. I just wanted to escape through the book. And it has kind of helped me later on in my life with all the reading I did. But I think I, you know, kind of probably cheated myself, too. I missed out on a lot of life, I think, with my sister and with growing up. So I didn't drink for a long time until I was 17. I'd had like a drink or two of wine that my mom had. I thought it was awful, and I thought it was kind of irresponsible of her to let me taste the wine. We would have assemblies in school, and they would talk about, like, if you drink, you're going to be an alcoholic, and it would just be very dramatic, and I believed them. You know, if I drank, I was going to drink and drive and get into an accident and be an alcoholic. And, you know, it was funny because it wasn't the truth for the other kids for the most part, but it was the truth for me. You know, I didn't get in accidents, I don't think, but But I definitely, you know, I was going to grow up to be an alcoholic. I believe I was an alcoholic from the start, because I had all those feelings that I hear you guys talk about at meetings that I felt. You know, I felt different. I felt, you know, uncomfortable. I watched other people do things in life that I just didn't understand how they could do. I didn't understand how they were doing those things. And so I had my first drink on a Girl Scout trip in Gulf Shores, Alabama. Some boys had Jack Daniel's Down Home Punch. I didn't have enough to get drunk, but I really liked it. I really liked, you know, hanging out with the boys, and it seemed cool and exciting, and I hadn't been very cool or exciting at all. And it wasn't cool or exciting, but it seemed that way. But I went back home, and this boyfriend and I, we had said that we weren't going to drink or whatever. We dated for like a year and a half or something in high school. And as soon as we broke up, right before our last semester of high school, we both started drinking, you know, pretty hard. I don't know why we didn't before. But so I had never been one of the – my high school was really small. You were kind of in the group or not in the group. I wasn't really in the group. But when I started drinking, I found I could hang out with people in the group, and they were nice to me. And you know, I think through drinking, I just didn't care as much. And, you know, I very quickly went from being this goody-two-shoes to the girl who just drank until she threw up or passed out. And then I remember, you know, people partying around me and stuff and, like, laying on the ground, and I couldn't move. I can just hear it, but I can't have fun. I can't do anything because I've gone way past the point. And that's how I drank from the very, very beginning. So I went to college, and, you know, one of the first events in college, I went to a hayride, and I drank a fifth of Jack Daniel's. No, not Jack Daniel's. I drank a lot of Jack Daniel's that last semester, but it was that cinnamon schnapps. And I heard somebody talking not too long ago, and they said, you know, people that drink, like, an entire bottle of schnapps or liqueurs are total alcoholics. You know, like, who else would do that? Nobody else would do that. So, yeah, it was awful. But that, I think that's when I had my first blackout. I, you know, heard somebody talking about, you know, this is gross, but I threw up more times than I could remember, and there were things I couldn't remember, and I realized I had missed, you know, I didn't know what it was then, but I had had a blackout, and that was the first of many, many, many blackouts. I was definitely a blackout drinker. And I also met this guy, and I really wanted something to make me feel better, make me feel okay, and, you know, as soon as I found this guy, he was a really cool guy. The guys that would date me or finally, you know, I could get to date me, they were always really actually pretty nice guys. Somehow I lucked out. But, you know, but then I would drive them crazy. But he was a Marine Corps recruiter, and that's kind of how I started talking to him, was I was going to talk to him about the Marine Corps. I wasn't really that interested in joining the Marine Corps. I just wanted to go out with him. But, you know, the next summer, I went to Marine Corps boot camp, and I went into the Marine Corps Reserves. And, yeah. I mean, I also had always kind of been this weakling kind of, you know, goody-two-shoes kind of girl, and I just kind of wanted to, you know, show everybody how I could be tough or, I don't know, be different. I still don't know. Sometimes people ask me, you know, people not in the program, well, why did you join the Marine Corps? It's hard sometimes. Sometimes I just want to say, because I'm an alcoholic, and I was crazy, and I did weird things for who knows why. But I can't say that. You know, well, I was, you know, I was 19 years old. There you go. And he was cute. So I went into the Marine Corps Reserves, and, you know, boot camp was an experience. But, you know, they let us go to church every Sunday, and I'm not really a religious person now, but those church services were really good. They were one of the only chances you could get of just kind of hanging out and not being badgered. And but I felt really that the only way I was going to get through that was with God. And my parents had always, you know, taught me to believe in God and had taken me to church as a kid and everything. And And I felt really close to God during that time, because I just felt that was the only way I was going to be able to get through this. And at the end of boot camp, I realized, and I almost started crying, because I realized at the end of boot camp, I was going to go back to my regular life, and that feeling of God being right with me all the time was going to leave. And that's exactly what happened. You know, I left boot camp, I went back to my old life, and God was no longer as necessary. And in fact, you know, as I moved on through my drinking, I didn't want God. The things that I was doing, the way I was living, the person that I was, I felt that God did not approve of me, and I just wanted to ignore that. And so I really got away from God. Let's see. I was in boot camp. Okay. So I'm back in school, and, you know, I'd been given a scholarship, and not a full one, but a nice scholarship. And, you know, when I'm drinking, when I was younger, my parents would really taught me to believe, even though there was a lot of fighting in the house, I always knew that they really loved me. And they let me know that they felt that I could do anything in the world, that anything was a possibility. And so I had all these dreams of things that I wanted to do, things I wanted to be. Like, all I had to do was choose, is what I felt like. And as I got older, and as I got more fearful, and as I started drinking especially, all of that stuff left me, you know, and I didn't know that it was leaving. All of the motivation, all of the dreaming, all of the desire left me because it was no longer, you know, an option. And as I created more and more wreckage, I didn't know how to get out from under the wreckage to do something in my life, to do something that, you know, would be worthwhile or that I would enjoy. I just have so much to be grateful for. And sometimes it's just not possible, I think, to feel the amount of gratitude or the amount of happiness that I really should or that is really worth feeling. And I'm just not capable of feeling that much. So I had stopped going to class. I had stopped applying myself. I had stopped trying. And I really hadn't tried that much to begin with. So when my friends who were a little bit older than me were graduating and going on to do different things and really cool things sometimes, you know, it was like, you know, I was 2 years in school. I had, you know, my transcript I looked at later, I was probably on the verge of being kicked out, but I decided I didn't want to do that anymore, and I moved in with my mom in Kansas City, Missouri. And, you know, my mom got to watch me, you know, wait tables and drink away my earnings and not pay rent to her, not pay bills. And, you know, thank God for her, I wasn't ever homeless. Thanks to her and my sister, I was never homeless. But I have years there that are like, they're just gone. You know, they're just gone. And I don't really know what happened to differentiate. We pretty much just did the same thing. I did that waiting tables life and going out afterwards and drinking sometimes till the sun came up and going to bed and then getting back up and waiting tables again. And so a few years later of doing that, and the whole time I'm in the reserves, you know, I'm doing that stuff. I'm not doing it very well. I'm just doing it as much as I can to keep from having really bad consequences. I wound up meeting a guy in a blackout in a bar, and he called me, like, the next day, and I'm living at this time in an apartment that had, like, no furniture. And one time I had this lady come and clean my apartment with no furniture, because I didn't want to clean it because I was just that lazy. But I can't imagine what she thought. Like, I have no furniture, but I'm paying for someone to clean my house. It just was not sane. So I meet this guy in a blackout. He calls me the next day. I don't know who this guy is, but hey, he sounds nice. I don't have a lot going on, so I go out, and I, you know, it's like a blind date is what it was, or at least a one-sided blind date. And so I go out and meet him, and, like, a couple months later, we move in, or I move in to his place. And, you know, he is in the Army. He's moving to Korea. And, you know, as soon as he told me he was moving to Korea, he didn't ask me yet, but I knew as soon as he told me that I was going to go to Korea. And he asked me to marry him a couple months later, and, you know, I moved to Korea with him. And, you know, the whole time, you know, we drank a lot together. And that's probably one of the reasons we didn't have a whole lot in common once I got in Korea and realized, you know, it's just him and me, and he has the access to base and the access to the liquor store on base. And, you know, there's only so much alcohol. He knows everything that we have. And although he drinks a lot, he's starting to say something, well, gosh, that bottle's really emptying fast. And, you know, so I'm having to buy the local Korean soju, I think it is. I'm kind of hiding it in the cabinet and adding it to my 7-Up or whatever. I look back later and remembered times when I didn't think I was drinking that much or whatever, and I'll look back and remember, oh, well, I did go to this wine store a lot, or I did go to this. I don't really know. My picture isn't very clear of how much I actually drank. But we fought. We fought a lot. And poor guy. So eventually I decided that I need to go back home. And I went back home, and I moved about a mile away from the Bar District in Kansas City. It was four of us girls living in the same apartment. And it was just the nastiest apartment I've ever lived in. And I drank every day. It was about the worst time of my drinking. And, I was hiding. My roommates wanted to drink my alcohol after I drank their alcohol, and I didn't think that was cool at all. And just mornings waking up and feeling this just, you know, the fear of impending doom and this huge, huge fear over me, trying to remember what I had done the night before and then trying not to remember what I had done the night before. Even if I couldn't remember anything bad, I just knew I had done something bad or said something weird or been bizarre or whatever. And I wasn't feeling good. So I woke up one morning and I thought, I can't live this way anymore. I can't live this way anymore. And my next thought was, well, then I'm going to have to stop drinking. And then my next thought was, I can't not drink on my own. I just knew that. I know people that said, oh, the whole time I knew I was an alcoholic. I was not. I was very unaware of me. I probably didn't want to look at me. To me, what was abnormal, I didn't grow up that way, but it had become normal for me. And so my next thought, I called up the 411 in Kansas City and asked them for the number for AA, and a woman came out and got me. She took me to find my car. She took me to breakfast. She told me her story. You know, this is my first contact ever with AA. And she took me home. I got cleaned up, and she came back and took me to my first meeting ever. And that's where they gave me this book. I still have it. And just barely. But it was the Unity Club in Kansas City, and almost on the plaza there. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was exactly where I was supposed to be. I had this feeling of I was safe, and it was okay, you know. And there was another guy there for his first meeting. His name was Bill Wilson, and I could not understand why they were so excited that his name was Bill Wilson. Whatever. But some of them split off, and they just kind of went around and told their stories. They kind of did this for me and Bill Wilson. and I just identified with what they said and their stories that they gave as alcoholics. And I cried, and I picked up a white chip, or I think it was, I don't know, silver or something there. In Charlotte, it's white, so that's what I'm used to now. But I picked up the chip, you know, the beginner chip or whatever. And, you know, I'd already decided I was going to move to Florida because my roommates and I had got into an argument, partly because I wanted to drink their alcohol and didn't want them to drink mine. And so I moved to Florida about a week later, and I thought I really wanted to stay sober. I really thought that I did. But I sat there in the meetings in Jacksonville where I moved, and, you know, I listened to people talking about getting a home group, and newcomers need to do service work, and newcomers need to get a sponsor. And I finally got a sponsor, but like, I didn't take those suggestions that they were saying and apply them to myself. I thought, oh, newcomers need to, well, I was a newcomer, you know. I didn't apply any of this to myself. And when I looked at the steps on the wall, I looked at 1 through 3, and I thought, no problem, I can totally do that. And I saw 4 and 5, and I said, never. I made a decision right then and there. I said, I will never do that. And, you know, and I went through step 3 with 1 through 3 with this sponsor, and, you know, and I knew that I wasn't going to take step 4 or 5, and I didn't then. And I also, you know, I drank non-alcoholic beer, and I thought that AA doesn't hurt them. Well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't hurt anybody in AA if I get drunk or if I do whatever. It hurts me. You know, that's who I'm hurting. And I took prescription pills, so I wasn't sober. I was just kind of hanging out, listening to what people were saying in AA. But it was really important that I did that, and I'm so glad that I did, because I moved up to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia. I had started to become started as a flight attendant. And I moved up to Pennsylvania, and I'd been going to to club meetings in Jacksonville. And it was hard meeting more in churches up in Philadelphia. And I was driving around. I was getting lost, and I couldn't find anything. It didn't seem like the people were that nice, and I stopped going. And on my first international trip to London, people were having beer and fish and chips, and I wanted to have beer and fish and chips, and I did. And I had one beer, and I went back to the hotel. And, you know, my drinking is not like a... My former great-grandsponsor talks about this, and I'm so glad she did, because I can totally identify with it. But how, you know, her drinking went up and down and up and down and up and down. It wasn't like a linear, you know, decline, and that's what mine did. I always kind of, like, you know, would start drinking more and more and more and more and more and more, and more blackouts, and then something would happen, and then it'd go down again and back up. So it kind of took me a little while, I think, to go back up, but I did, and those blackouts started all over again. And I wound up in Florida about a year and a half later, and back there, right back there, only this time that last night was worse. It was a lot worse. And I was freaking out on the phone with a friend of mine, and because of everything I'd done the night before and how embarrassed and ashamed I felt of who I was, and she said, you need to go back to AA. And it was just like it was in all caps, you know, like huge. And I was like, yeah, you're right. And if she hadn't said that, I mean, I'm not really a big fan of saying you need to do anything or you need to go to AA or whatever, but that's what I needed to hear, and that's what worked for me. I was in Key West, Florida on a trip, and I called up AA, and I went to the Anchors Away group, their clubhouse there in Key West, and I picked up a chip. And, you know, I cried, and I think it's always good to cry if you're picking up a white chip. I like that when I see newcomers. It's good to feel that pain, and I felt like I was gonna want to die if I kept living the way that I was living. And so that same day, I found out that they were closing my base, my flight attendant base in Jacksonville, and I was gonna have to move for sure. But I didn't know where. It's kind of a big day for me. But we, in Jacksonville, those 2 months I was there, I went ahead and got a sponsor, and I went to multiple meetings a day, and just like kept going, like. Just remember, I drove like 40 minutes every day to this clubhouse in Jacksonville to avoid the clubhouse where my old sponsor went. And but she would have been so happy. I know now anytime I see somebody I used to sponsor in a meeting or run into them or whatever, or anybody that I used to see that I didn't see, I'm so happy. Like, I'm just so happy. And, you know, whatever, that was my pride. But it was fine. It worked. I drove 40 minutes out. You know, I'd go back home, and later on in the day, I'd go back out 40 minutes and just drive and focus, you know, like, not going to drink. And so then I moved up to Charlotte, and it was really scary because I was moving from Jacksonville, going to club meetings. I moved up to Charlotte. The meetings were in churches. I got lost. I'd go late. I didn't know anybody. And that was fine. I kept going because I wanted to stay sober more than anything in this world. I didn't want to drink anymore. And it was a real, I didn't want to drink anymore, and I kept going. And I walked into this meeting one night, because I kept going to meetings and nothing felt right, you know, but I kept going, and I did. I got to this meeting, I don't know, I was there a month or maybe 2 months. I don't think 2 months, maybe a month, month and a half. And I walked into a meeting, and I looked around, and it was a pretty big meeting, but, like, I felt at home. And after the meeting, this woman walked up to me and tapped me on the shoulder. And, you know, she gave me her phone number. And I just, like, she talked to me, and she seemed serene. And, you know, she just seemed to kind of have it together. And I called her the next day, and I just kind of decided she was going to be my sponsor. And, you know, I called her every day for, like, 2 years until she told me, don't call me every day anymore. You know, like, you need to have some dependence on God. Like, 2 nights later, we went out after this meeting, Queen City meeting. If you're ever in Charlotte, it's kind of a big meeting. It's a good meeting to go to Mondays and Friday nights. And we went out for coffee and chili or something afterwards, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, you know, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yes. And she said, you know, once I take you through the steps, are you willing to freely pass this on to somebody else? And, well, of course I said yes, and I'm thinking, yeah, right. You know, like, I'm never going to be at a place where I can pass this on to somebody else. You know, then she also told me, you know, in the morning I needed to get down on my knees by my bed and ask God to keep me sober that day. And at night I needed to, again, you know, thank God for keeping me sober that day. And, you know, and she took me through the steps, and I got really active in the program there in Charlotte. I found this girl, and she was, like, at every meeting I went to. And, you know, she did not like me. She was not nice to me. But I was just, like, on fire. Like, if you're a woman in a meeting and I see you, especially if I see you more than once or whatever, I'm going to get your number. We're going to schedule. We're going to go to coffee. And, you know, I just knew. I don't know if Candace, my first sponsor, told me this or what, but I knew that, like, you needed to stay sober. I needed to stay sober. This is a life or death thing. So even if you don't want me to call you, it's okay because it's good for you. So I need to call you, you know. And I'm doing you a favor whether you like it or not. And I'm just helping to keep you sober. So so I would do that. I would call women and go out to coffee with women, and it was awkward. And the whole thing of it was, you know, I've never been one to like, you know, meeting people, or I get really anxious, you know, that whole self-centered fear. But I had a mission and I had a reason, so that made it all okay. It was okay. And so this girl, Heather, so I make, you know, she doesn't like me, but I see her and she's new. So we go to coffee and she's angry and I have my own things. But eventually she's calling me 3-4 times a day. And she was 3 weeks ahead of me, and her sponsor and my sponsor had the same sponsor, and we went to the same home group. And, you know, just for like, pretty much that first year, we ran around Charlotte together and went to meetings together. And I knew that if I was up at 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning, which I was a lot my first year, I could call her and she would be up too. And we could talk and whatever it was, you know, and we could talk about our sponsors. She was ahead of me in the staff, so I could say, well, what's this like? You know, what's this like? And I think, you know, every newcomer, we call them running buddies in Charlotte. I just think that's the greatest thing, and it helped both of us really stay sober. And we had other, you know, running buddies too, but that's always going to be special for me, was that relationship. And I got to catch my breath. I'm sorry. I talk really fast, especially when I'm nervous. But just hope everyone can keep up. And so Candace took me through the steps, and she took me through 1, 2, and 3, and those I pretty much, you know, I did feel like I was an alcoholic, but I think that realization of I am an alcoholic, and I can never drink, and I have no control over my relationship with alcohol is completely out of my control. It's God. But I think my realization of step one just grows deeper, I think, the longer I stay sober. And step two, you know, I don't know, step two, I've always believed in a higher power, but that relationship, again, grows stronger. And my conception of who God is really changed for me a lot. Because when I came in, that kind of punishing God, the God that I felt like disapproved of me, I found out I don't have to believe in that. You know, I can believe in a God that feels real to me, and it may not feel real to anyone else, but that's completely and totally okay, because it's my God, and that's my higher power is what works for me, and that's what's keeping, you know, me sober, and that's what I pray to. And the third step, I think, is really big for me. I was in this kind of silly, like, service fraternity, and the first time I was in college, because now there's a second time, and a third time, too, which is cool. But the first time I was in college, I joined the service fraternity. One of those kind of the silly things we did as part of the initiation was you, like, I don't know, you stand on a table or something, you fall, and they all catch you. But for me, that's, like, I guess it was helpful for me, because that's kind of how I think about the third step, is just falling back and knowing, you know, that God's going to be there. God's got me. God's going to catch me. And I just have to trust in God and do my part, and God's going to do the rest. And it's all going to be okay. Like, even if, I've heard somewhere, even if I die, if that's the worst, which is not the worst thing that can happen, but I believe that's going to be okay. You know, God's going to be there, and it's going to be perfectly even better than now. But anyway, that's kind of getting off track. Sorry. And the fourth step, you know, the steps that I said I was never, ever going to do, the fourth and fifth step, all that stuff that if somebody knew about me, they would hate me, and all that icky, yucky stuff that was me when I was drinking, it was so pathetic and so desperate and just so selfish and yucky. And so kind of getting all that stuff out, you know, and put it on paper and that my part stuff and, you know, taking it to her and driving over to see her and I didn't want to do it, but I wanted to stay sober much more than I wanted to keep my pride, or I didn't really have any pride, or keep whatever, keep somebody from knowing all that stuff about me. But I drove anyway, and, you know, we started off, and she told me something really bad about her, you know, and it made it okay. And it was a perfect visual aid because I got to see her in this nice life she had, this confidence and the serenity that she had, the person that she was, and at the time she seemed perfect to me. And see her and then hear her, she was just like me, you know, she was the same as me. And she had done what I was getting ready to do, and she, through that, got to be where she was, you know, and I got, it gave me faith, and it gave me this, you know, it just really helped me to do this and to trust it was going to be okay. And so I did that step, and it was okay. You know, I've never, ever had a sponsor yell at me. I've never had a sponsor say, ew, you're gross, or I can't believe you. You know, I've never had that happen. They usually are like, oh, yeah, I did that, you know, and I've said, so it's okay. And then I did 6 and 7, and I'm still, you know, that's still, I think, part of, people say you can't work on your character defects, but it says in 6 and 7, you know, you got to do the work and God does the rest. And I believe, you know, I've got to do stuff that I don't want to do. And sometimes I got to do a lot of stuff that I do want to do, or, yeah, don't do. There's this woman in Renee S. in Charlotte, and she says, you know, one is like, don't do what you want to do and do what you don't want to do. And I never can remember which is 6 and 7, so I just think, that sums it up. But, you know, I have to do my part, definitely, and God does the rest. And there are, I'm nothing like I used to be, but I can see more and more defects all the time, like that manipulation stuff that's been on my mind lately. Like, I still try to get responses from people, and I still do this, that, and the other, that, you know, that's, I keep finding things that make me uncomfortable, which I think is good. All right, so then we went through the 8th and 9th, and all of this stuff over my head, this IRS stuff and this debt stuff and all this stuff that I didn't think I could ever get out from under. I actually asked my sponsor if I could start making some of those payments a little early, and she said yes, you know, that's fine. And so, you know, that first couple of years, you don't make a lot of money as a flight attendant, but I had was very fortunate in the way my circumstances, my finances were at the time. I didn't have a whole lot of bills. And I was self-supporting, but rent was cheap and whatever. But so I paid off a ton of stuff. Like, it was gone. Like, all the stuff I never thought I would get through, and I got through. And it was, like, just amazing what happens when you go one step at a time, one step at a time. And that's how people do those things. You know, that's how all those people out there do this or the other that I never understood. And so once AA taught me to do steps 1 through 12, one at a time and in order, I started to learn, oh, you can do that with so many other things in your life, one step at a time, one baby tiny step at a time. And it completely, you know, I can apply that to anything now. And I wish I could apply it to my house, but I don't. So 8 and 9, and I made amends to my family. And, you know, sometimes it didn't, you know, with a couple people in my family, it didn't go quite the way I wanted it to or I thought that it would, and that's okay. You know, my sponsor told me I just have to clean up my side of the street and let them say what they have to say and not argue, you know, and leave it at that. And then I've also, you know, living amends with my family is trying to be there. I've been one to not be there, you know, to just not be there, not be available. And I have to try to be available now. You know, my sister's wedding was a couple of weeks ago, and I did not want to go, but I went, and it was amazing. And I'm so glad that I was there, and the whole time I was so conscious of what it would have been like if I'd been there and not been sober. I mean, if I wasn't sober, I you know, probably would not have been there. And B, if I was there, I would have made it about me, and I would have ruined it. And I was able to just be there and just be there for her and not at all for me, you know, and be there for some other people that kind of, I think, needed somebody from AA to be there. And I wasn't there as a member of AA, but I got to be there. I don't know, somebody commented on, she could see the difference in me. She hadn't seen me since I'd been drinking. And so it's been like, she hadn't seen me in like 6 years. And she said, you know, she could see a difference in me. And this was somebody that I didn't get along with, you know, and I was so glad that she could see a difference and I was able to be nice to her and be a good person. So family. And then 10, 11, 12. 10, you know, I was taught with the walking around step, that step when I'm going to say something, and maybe this isn't really the right thing to say right now. And then times when I say it anyway, or say it, and most of the time I know when I'm saying something I shouldn't say, I have a weird feeling, but I'll still say it sometimes anyway, and then I can go back, and when I get that sick feeling, go back and make amends for that. And usually when I make amends, they don't remember what I'm talking about, which is another reason why I don't need to be so self-centered, because they don't remember, not that important, or it's not a big deal. They're like, oh, okay, that's cool, that's great. And 11, not a big meditator. I pray a lot. I forget a lot in the morning. I always pray every night, and I pray throughout my day. You know, Candace, that first sponsor, she taught me that, you know, I can always say, God, please give me the words. Please give me the words to say, you know, before I talk to my sponsee, before I go into work stuff, school stuff, whatever, I can say that, and God is always there for me. And then step 12 has been awesome. I've sponsored a lot of women, and I don't know, you know, I don't know how many of them are still sober, but I'm still sober, and it has been a joy because I talk to them so often, and I'm saying something, you know, a couple months ago, I was like freaking out over stuff, just really stressed out, and I had my sponsee called me, and she was concerned about some stuff, and, you know, I was able to say, you know, God's got it. All you have to do is do your part and do one day at a time, and God's in charge, and it's everything's going to be okay. And, like, that's exactly what I needed to hear, you know. And that's happened so many times, you know, when I'm saying stuff. And I know it's like, you know, words are coming out of my mouth. And, you know, just like when I'm in a meeting and I hear something and I'm like, okay, God, you know, like, people talk to me all the time through people, through you guys, you know, through people, normal people, you know, or whatever they are. I don't know if anyone's normal, but people that are not alcoholic. And I just have to be aware and be there for it, to hear it when it comes. And so, you know, as a flight attendant for the first couple of years of my sobriety and my sponsor, you know, I'm just living, learning to pay bills and learning to, you know, show up to AA and learning to do all this normal stuff and the people, other people always knew. And, you know, doing that, and I wanted to quit my job because I hated it, and my sponsor kept saying, no, 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 you know, don't just quit it because you hate it, like, just paying your bills. And then I had a friend, I lived next door to her, and I just moved next door to this girl, and she came over, I'm not a big friendly kind of person, but she came over and started this friendship with me, and I thought, great, this is my first normal, non-alcoholic friend. And of course, one day, for this long story reason I won't go into, I told her, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I'm sober, and she said, you know, I think I might be an alcoholic. Gosh darn. But, you know, so I live next door to her, and she told me later that she felt sorry for me because I wasn't going out to bars and whatever. I was just going to work and having fun, just, you know, with this kind of quiet lifestyle, sober lifestyle. And, you know, a few months later, she called me, and she said, you know, take me to a meeting. And I took her to a meeting, and she picked up a chip. And, you know, she picked up 3 years in September. And I've got to watch her life completely change in this amazing way. And she's following her dreams. And it's awesome. And we lived there together, kind of next door to each other. And so I was telling her, about she was a month or two sober, and I was like, I really want to go back to school. And the pilot that I flew with, I had been telling him I want to go to school, whatever. He's like, you always say that. You're never going back to school. You always say that, and you never do anything about it. Well, I am so thankful to him, and I've had a chance to talk to him fairly recently, and he was so cool, and I'm so grateful to him that he said that to me. I don't think I told him, you know, I don't remember, but that kind of made me mad. So I talked to Colette, and, you know, she had gone to school. You know, she was just new getting sober, but she knew all about school and what you needed to do and all the stuff. I had no idea, FAFSA, all this paperwork stuff, all this stuff. And she made a list for me. It was October of, like, 2004, and she's like, this is the stuff that you need to do. You know, she started a list for me, and tomorrow you're going to do this, this, and this thing. And so I would go through her list and do everything on the list, and then I'd come back to her and be like, okay, well, what do I do now? What do I do now? And she just walked me through that process. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why I know that God exists, because I needed her there. She was the perfect person for me there. I was a perfect person to live next to her. And God put us in each other's lives, and our lives have completely changed because we were there for each other. And so I went back to school, and that first night she told me that I stayed awake all night long. That was something that would happen a lot during my first year. One, because I was used to drinking and fasting out, and I didn't, you know how to sleep, I think, by that time without alcohol. So I would stay awake a lot at night when I was first getting sober. And but sometimes I was staying awake because I had this whole brand new life. It was like in Wizard of Oz when it goes from black and white to Technicolor. It was just like that. It was like, life, this is life, and this is it, and I can do anything now. That whole feeling of back that I had when I was 5 or 6 years old came back, and I can do stuff now. I can do stuff. And so sometimes I was staying awake all night long because I was so excited about the possibilities that God had out there for me. And I had no idea then. I had no idea of the things I was going to get to do. They're just even so much better and so much greater than I thought then. And or maybe not. Maybe I didn't think it was. I don't know. But I don't think I would have. I don't know. Anyway, so I go back to school, and I'm starting in community college. And I had a 7:30 a.m. class that first semester, but you know, I put one foot in front of the other, and I remember going through that parking garage, and it was dark. I was thinking, every foot that I put, you know, closer, every step I take, I'm getting closer to graduating. And every class I took was getting me closer to graduating. And, you know, and so I went to four-year school after a year of community college. And I had stuff I enrolled in this chemistry course. And the teacher scared the heck out of me. She said, it's only for science majors. You can't do this. Or not me personally, but if you're not. But I didn't think I could do it, and I just stuck with it. And I was a top person in the class because I studied. I studied and studied and studied. And it just helped me to see that I don't know what I'm capable of. I don't know what I can do. God knows what I can do. And so sometimes when there are things in front of me, I can't do this. I have no idea. That's not true. I just need to look at it one problem, one step at a time. And you know, whatever God wants me to accomplish, I'm going to accomplish. So I went to this four-year school, and I did the whole deal. I did school government, just like I was 20 years old or something, and it was so much fun, and I made a lot of friends. I didn't know these good kids existed. There are kids out there who go to college, and they don't drink, and not for any particular reason sometimes, just because they don't drink, and they're good kids, and they want to get good grades, and they want to have good lives and make money and stuff, and so I found those people, you know, I did an internship, and I came up here last summer, and I had decided I wanted to do a particular career, and it was a really hard career to get into, and I took the test for it last summer, and I didn't pass, and I was devastated because I had really decided this is what I was going to do, and you know, then I applied for this fellowship where they pay for your school, and then you get to do the career that I wanted to do. And, I got that fellowship. So now I'm going to do the career that I want to do, and they're going to pay for me to get a master's degree, which is way better than what I wanted, which was just to take the test and wait 2 years and then start doing the career, you know. So God has a plan for me that I don't know. So I moved up here, you know, to go to grad school. And I left all those people in Charlotte, that whole network I had. You know, I can go to a meeting there and, oh, it's Carrie. You know, and they know who I am. They know where I come from. They know who my sponsor is. You know, they know what I look like. You know, when I'm not having a good day, I think. You know, and I can walk up to any one of them and say, you know, even if I don't know them very well, because I don't know everyone there, but I can walk up to them and say, hey, I'm having a problem, and I know they're going to listen to me, they may even help me, or they may have coffee with me, or whatever. And so I'm leaving all of that, and I came up here, and I was pretty terrified. You know, I can still get terrified. You know, but I got a home group right away, I got a service commitment right away, and I got a sponsor right away. And, you know, I've really tried. I don't have that fire. I wish I did, that I had my first year. But, you know, part of it is just doing it. You know, it's not some big thing. All I have to do to have that fire is just to do that stuff. So sometimes I'm better at it than others. But I have got numbers, and I do have friends up here. And I do have a little part-time job, and I'm going to do this with friends, I'm going to do that with friends. And sometimes I wonder if, like, my roommate or somebody wonders, like, okay, she just moved up here. How does she have all of these friends? But AA is great, and I know I can go anywhere. And you know, part of my job in the future is going to be living God knows where. And, you know, but I have faith that I think I can do anything. I can go anywhere, and I can stay sober, and God's going to take care of me. I just cannot drink anywhere that I go. And I have to stay in, you know, I have to be spiritually fit and do those things that I need to do. I think if I go any farther, I'm going to be filling, but I do want to read one thing. And it's my favorite part of the big book. I don't know, though. I read different stuff. I'm like, wow, that's so great. And I think I read stuff more now and be like, and I'm like, wow, that's so great ever than I ever have before. But it's on page 100, and it says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Thanks.